This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
As from the teachings of Master Jingang, Part 2, this floating life, an ever-changing dream, yet we bitterly toil away. The entire day full of busyness as our karma grinds us down. If only you can make a clean sweep of the cave of ignorance, you'll be left with a life full of leisurely freedom and ease. Human life and this mirage of a world are kept going by desire. Once desire stops, all is the realm of the great enlightened one. The masters of the heavens and hells will find themselves speechless. Having poked through the web, there will be no conditions of desire. The mind always composed and calm, that is the original purity. Careful study and accumulation of facts, turbid worldly emotions. If you immediately change your life and step onto the further shore, your ignorance will shatter on its own with a laugh and song. Understand the ordinary mind and realize one is naturally complete. Ask urgently who you were before your mother and father were born. When you have seen through the method that underlies them all, then the mountain blossoms and flowing streams will rejoice with you. So I mentioned the other day, Jingang was lived in the 1600s, first half of the 1600s, 17th century, China. She was a Buddhist nun who came to the Dharma early in life, as I told a little bit about her life, but but wasn't able to really take it up in terms of more formal training until she had already lived a life, being married, losing her husband in death, taking care of her parents and in-laws until she was freed of that obligation. And then she entered the monastery and trained and spent the rest of her life as a monastic and then as a teacher, having her own convent, her own monastery. And as I mentioned, she was well-regarded, well-known, such that people came to study with her, challenge her, test her understanding. When she was dying, she had seven disciples that she transmitted to. And when she was dying, one of them wrote this poem. For the past 20 years, she's been our teacher. Truly unique and alone, her staff flashing up and down. When did the smoke from her quarters dwindle away, leaving her children and grandchildren as they were before? And Beata Grant, who compiled this collection of poems, comments on this and said the last line reflects the fact that Jingang had in many ways become a second mother to her female disciples. And she says the nature of this relationship is perhaps most dramatically evidenced by the fact that one of her disciples, when Jingang was ill and dying, cut a piece of her own flesh and made it into a broth, a medicinal broth. And this was something that was done at that time, usually within the family. It didn't work so well for Jingang, nor did it work for the woman who cut her flesh out. So we won't try that. And this comment about her being a second mother, the teacher is not the parent. Sometimes that analogy is used. But the teacher is not a parent and the student is not a child. And that is not their relationship. Of course, the student-teacher relationship shares some characteristics of many different kinds of relationships. Parent-child, friends, other kinds of teacher-student relationships that we've had. Sometimes adversary. But it's its own thing. And it's and what makes it particular and unique is its purpose. And its purpose is to teach the Dharma, to convey the Dharma, to transmit the Dharma, to awaken the student. And those other kinds of characteristics, those other characteristics from our many different kinds of relationships may very well be there, but if they become too primary, too important in a sense, then the purpose of the reason that the student has come to the teacher can very easily become blurry. And it's part of the teacher's role is to keep that clear. This is my opinion. And as time goes on, it's also the student's responsibility to also keep that clear. And that it changes over time as well, that what that relationship, what this relationship is in the beginning, you know, evolves. It goes through changes as the student is evolving. Leaving her children and grandchildren as they were before. In other words, you are as you were. You come as you were, and you will leave as you were. Training is not about changing you, turning you into something different. You are now as you were before, a Buddha. You have enlightened nature. Having found your way here, in a sense, traditionally, that's considered one of the most difficult parts of the journey. They said Master Jingang, in her latter period of life, her health continued to deteriorate, and two of her disciples, Yingong and Yichuan, were asked by Jingang and agreed to take over the teaching and the responsibilities of the convent, of the monastery. However, Yichuan passed away after only a couple of years, and Yikuang was left alone with the responsibility, which was considerable. It's a lot of responsibility. And when the funeral for Jingang was happening, her disciple, Yigong, spoke these words. She said, "Alas, there was no one like you, my Dharma sister, the monastic from Banro. Your heart was like that of a naked child. Your actions were like those of the ancients. You were clever while appearing awkward, wise while appearing foolish, eloquent while appearing inarticulate, and iron strong while appearing soft. You treated others as you would treat yourself and fully exhausted the possibilities of both humans and heaven. You and I share the same way of life, but you have abandoned me and entered the realm of the deathless." Actually, when the teacher dies, they become, in a certain sense, even more available, because they're no longer constricted by a physical form. And so they can be available to the student in any way that is needed. This is very much my experience. And so, picking up in the middle of this poem of her teaching, "The mind always composed and calm, that is the original purity. Careful study and accumulation of facts, turbid worldly emotions." the mind always composed and calm. That is the original purity. This teaching is presented in 100,000 ways from the beginning with the Buddha. This is the essence of the journey. This is the, in a sense, the point. Is that from the beginning, this original purity of mind, which is not restricted in any way to anything, which means that original purity is the purity of all things, of all aspects of self, of everything that arises, everything that appears, everything that exists. This mind is still and radiant, unified, calm, clear, boundless. Dogen speaks of it in Fukan Sazengi as the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. How could it be contingent on practice and realization? Being pure originally, practice and realization are not necessary. The true vehicle is self-sufficient. Why apply special effort? The whole body is free from dust. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? It's never apart from this very place. What's the use of traveling around to practice? And yet, if there's a hair's breadth deviation, it's like the gap between heaven and earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. And remember that the Dogen, the speaker of these words, traveled to China. He traveled around a bit himself to practice, to find a teacher. Having done so, having realized his original purity, he was then able to speak now from a place of knowing, of confidence, of conviction. What is the use of traveling around to practice? And yet, if we don't step forward, as he said, then we can't encounter the Dharma. But what is always composed and calm? Perfect and all-pervading, as Dogen says. Nothing is permanent, not mindfulness, not concentration, not a vow or right intention, not understanding, not any experience that we have is permanent. And so that's why if we sort of take this path in its fruition to be having an experience, that's really no different than the mindset that is everywhere. You know, so Trungpa Rinpoche spoke of a spiritual materialism. I've had this, this doesn't work, but if I get this, that'll work. And so, of course, experiences are part of the journey because in every moment, as long as there is a self present, there is experience. But it's not having an experience, because that too is impermanent. That's why when we get so elated at having a great session or having experienced some deeper mind or samadhi or insight, and then we see that slipping through our fingers, right? Which really means the sort of experience, the embodied experience of that, whatever that might be, which may just be more emotional. We think that we're losing something. But we never had something. And because we're kind of stubborn and a little thick-headed, we have to go through that over and over and over. It's the same cycle of samsara, gaining, seeking, gaining, losing, disappointment, seeking, gaining, losing, seeking, gaining, losing, yeah, disappointment. Until we realize, just like the other cycles, just get off the wheel. Stop. grasping. There is this original mind, composed and calm in its very nature, which is like the ocean, right? It's so deep, so broad, so immovable. And there are the waves. Some are small, some are large. They can be gentle and comforting. They can be crashing and destructive. But when the wind calms, the waves grow more slight. When the wind stops, the waves cease. When she says, always composed and calm, I understand always as the stability. We could think of that as the stability that has developed over time. That in the moment, as we're developing our practice, we have moments, brief instants of calm or stability, composure, equanimity, and then they leave. And then again, and then they leave. But over time, those begin to sustain. They deepen. They extend themselves. It becomes more continuous. And that's a natural part of the journey. It's the natural mind. When allowed, when not being continually swept up by the wind. And because, we've been wind riders our whole lives, and that seems to be where all the action is, it's hard to give that up. But as the wind blows more gently, ceases blowing, then the waves cease. We can think of this always composed and calm, as the mind ocean. So there's the mind waves, and there's the mind ocean, which is never moving. Nor is it still. It's not a thing. Can't be defined. And this is why having faith is so important, because when we hear these teachings, she's speaking directly from her experience. This is what she knows. This is what she has discovered through her own practice, through doing what we're doing. When that's not yet our experience, we need to rely on our faith. Both our faith in such teachers speaking to us from this place deep within, but also from the faith within ourselves, that why not? How could this not be your mind? How could this not be within your capacity? I mean, in some of my most difficult moments, sitting right here in this zendo, when I thought, okay, I'm the one who is uniquely unfit for this. It's not working, not coming together, I can't do it. My mind's a mess. My meditation's a shit. But there, in the midst of that, there'd be moments where I would think, okay, now hang on. Like, I'm not especially great, but I'm not especially, deficient either. I'm just me. I'm just ordinary. And so why shouldn't I have the same capacity? Shouldn't I? But then she says, careful study and accumulation of facts, turbid worldly emotions. It's like speaking from that place of original purity, she recalls how we get pulled back in. We can study the Dharma, mind, body, the world, through our active grasping intellect, wanting to understand, delighting in new ideas and concepts and making connections, very powerful. The Buddha said it's the intellectual satisfaction, the pleasure, the sensual pleasure of intellectual satisfaction is very strong. And it is. You know, when I was studying mathematics, I don't know when I realized it. Before I left, because that was part of my leaving, I realized, because, you know, I was getting close to finishing my degree, and I was going to, wanted to be a school teacher, and, you know, sort of bringing mathematics into the world. And I realized that I didn't care that much about mathematics, actually. The reason I enjoyed it so much was more kind of sensual. It was aesthetic. It was aesthetically beautiful. And I enjoyed how it messed with my mind. I enjoyed the experience of wrestling with very difficult problems because I wasn't a genius by any means. I had to work really hard. But the experience of that and then the release, the pleasure, the satisfaction of understanding something after a struggle or of resolving some problem was very gratifying. And the more I realized that, the more I thought, I'm not sure that's a good motivation to spend the rest of my life devoted to teaching this. We can study within our faith and inquiring mind, driven by an imperative, a desire, a deep, often not fully understood need to understand something. To understand something that is beyond what we have understood so far. And to understand it in a way that we have not yet understood things. An inner sense that we have to somehow reach into or unlock some capacity we have to gain understanding, to experience things, to see things differently. In a sense, as we continue, we're learning how to let the Dharma study the Dharma, to let the self study the self, mind study the mind, to free ourselves of the swirl of the turbid worldly emotions. You know, in all of the ways in which emotions are spoken about in the teachings, the kleshas, there are, you know, afflictive emotions, there are entanglements, you know, they're so much of the root of suffering, you know, can bring us to the conclusion that there's something inherently wrong about our emotions, which is not true. It's not true about anything, but it's definitely not true about emotions. It's not that they in and of themselves, it's how it is that they come to be. What is their underlying basis? What's the stuff of our emotions? Karmically. Mind. Grasping, attachments, fears. What is the emotion itself? Why does it grab us so? Why are they so powerful? You know, from an evolutionary point of view, we have to think they are there to serve a purpose. Right? They are inextricable from our humanness. And yet, being so powerful, as the Buddha said, like a snake, if we don't hold it well, then it will bite us. And so when the emotions are no longer turbid, not muddy or unclear, they don't make it difficult to see, they still arise, but they're not the same. In a sense, we have liberated them from their turbidity. We've freed them. Just like we're freeing our thoughts, we're liberating our thoughts. Just think of that. Every time you let go, you're setting a prisoner free. How wonderful. How generous of you. Being free now, it can be free. It can live freely. Living freely, it doesn't constrict. But it is in these realms that practice is so challenging. You know, it's not rising early. It's not practicing continuously. It's not ango or sesshin. It's not the hours on the meditation seat. It's not living in close contact with sangha. It's not getting what you want. In a way, these are minor things. But if you take all of those things and really anything, and we see, how do I perceive this? How do I respond to it? How do I hold on to it? How do I reject it? What do I do with it? What does it seem to do with me? In possession of it, what do I do to you? That's the challenge. From that passage of Chunkpa Rinpoche when he said, hardship is necessary, that's what he was talking about. And it's necessary because life is dukkha. It's part of life. We can't avoid it. And it's necessary because since it is unavoidable, it's how we do the work. It's how we work things out. Right? It's like going on the trip of a lifetime but never leaving home. It's not going to happen. And as we go on, what we realize is that everything that we have experienced and took and understood and been afraid of and reacted to as hardship wasn't. That so much of the time where we were looking even to try and help ourselves was just slightly off the point. But experiencing the difficulty and the rigors of our own mind and of training, because it's rigorous, we over and over again come to a precipice. You know, the image of being caught between two iron mountains. You can't back up. You can't go forward. Now what? And those precipices are the moments of turning, the moments of possibility, the moments of awakening. And so she says, if you immediately change your life and step onto the further shore, your delusion will shatter on its own with a laugh and a song. If you immediately change your life, if we don't bend, if we don't yield, change will happen, but not in the direction we're hoping. And this is what everybody wants, right? We want our life to immediately change. We want to show up on the other shore, the shore of enlightenment, Prajnaparamita, and laugh and sing. And she's saying, okay, do that, please. But what is she really saying? It's, you know, it's basically inevitable that in hearing words and hearing the teachings, we will project and idealize. It's what we do with language. You know, it's like you can make a documentary. You know, somebody could shoot a documentary of us practicing together during sesshin. No performance, nothing. We're just doing what we do. Right? No gloss. Nothing extra, just this. And somebody sitting down and watching that movie would idealize what we're doing. What they're seeing on the screen is not what we're doing. They're seeing a depiction. They're gazing at the mountain from a distance. They're seeing something, but it's not what we're doing. And so we do that. But then we have to find our way through that and let go of those projections and idealizations when we realize that's what they are. Within the ever-changing dream, change your life. Dream yourself awake. Wake up from the dream. Waking up from the dream is dreaming yourself awake. The dream is not the problem. The dream is just a way of speaking about how our mind constructs everything. It's not wrong. And it's a dream. It's a dream in the sense that it doesn't exist by itself, on its own, somewhere, separate from you and me. Within the ever-changing dream, change your life. So we let go rather than hold on. We begin to learn how to really take responsibility rather than blame and make excuses. We learn how to turn towards rather than away. How to cultivate faith rather than doubt and cynicism. We develop the capacity to begin to see ourselves as perfect and complete and flawed and not broken. Changed. And in this change, when that changes, less and less is their disappointment. I was talking to somebody in a group of students earlier, and one of the students was talking about how difficult the week had been so far, but then there was a shift, and it opened up, and they were feeling really, really positive. I said, that's great, and that's going to change too. Right? Which is not to take away his joy, but it is to caution him about trying to hold on to that experience. Immediately, she says, immediately change your life. Immediately means, why wait any longer? It means you only have today. Don't wait till tomorrow. It means don't wait for someone to come and save you. Don't wait for yourself to come and save you. It means take refuge now. It means right now, this mind is composed and calm, originally pure. And if immediately seems too demanding, asking a bit much, well, what if she said, when you're ready, if you don't mind, when you like, when it's convenient, when you have a moment, change your life and step onto the other shore. No, immediately. And this change has to be continually clarified. What does it mean to change? Everything is changing. So why aren't I changing too? Why isn't this all about you changing yourself? Well, if nothing changed, then what's that about? Right? Then samsara just continues unabated. But then why... In the faith mind, Shi Dao said, the changes that occur in the empty world we call real only because of our delusion. What is this change? And what do we do with that in our mind? So if you think, I need to change this, I want to change, what are we doing in our mind with the idea of change? There is only one arising in this moment that the Buddha said is to be experienced. It doesn't belong to you. You can't keep it. It is not your possession. It leaves in its arising, same moment. So fast, we can't see it. And then there's another arising and passing, and another, endlessly. That is the only unchanging continuum. We call it consciousness. We call it the self. And within this sense of changing, where nothing is fixed, nothing is predetermined, the habits of ourself, the strength of our different identities are far stronger than we can suspect, can imagine. And so we practice within each moment, throughout the day, throughout our lives. We turn in and examine, see, both developing this mind that is composed and calm and also experiencing that very mind. Xingang said in another poem, said, a single meditation cushion and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the great universe assembles on the tip of a feather. What kind of protection is she speaking of? Zazen is not a retreat, it's not a withdrawal, it's not an escape. It's really being let into the dragon's lair. It's the very place where we meet, truly, finally, sadness, anger, elation, deep relaxation, mind. You protect yourself by not dividing yourself, by not denying and going to battle against any aspect of what we call the self, of not becoming. Rather, just let it crumble. When you see it building up, just let it crumble. Let it fall away on its own. In other words, free it. Don't imprison it, free it. Let it fulfill its nature. Just like every living creature, abiding in its own Dharma state, covering the ground upon which it stands. So let your thoughts and emotions and sensations and concerns fulfill their own nature. Their nature is to come as they go, go as they come. Their nature is not to bind you, not to trap you, not to define you. This protection is not turning our back on heaven and earth. When she says, this collapse always happens in this moment, in one moment. Dogen says, continuous practice that actualizes itself is no other than your continuous practice right now. The now of this practice is not originally possessed by the self. The now of this practice does not come and go. The word now does not exist anywhere else. The moment when it is actualized is called now. Understand the ordinary mind, Xingang says, and realize the one who is naturally complete. Ask urgently who you were before your father and mother were born. When you have seen through the method that underlies everything, the mountain blossoms, flowing streams will rejoice with you. Your everyday mind is Buddha mind. Your composed and calm mind is not even a little bit different from your disturbed and restless mind. How can that be? Not different recognizes their differences. Not different is recognizing the mind ocean, that there is only one mind. And that one mind, as all things, like the ocean itself, appears differently. And yet when we're pulled into a sense of disturbance, then the whole thing can seem disturbed. And so to continually come back to these teachings, realize the one who's naturally complete, and ask urgently who you were before your father and mother were born. This is a koan that we work with. It's a koan that she worked with. Before all creation, before knowing, before any involvement, before the arising of any sign or characteristic, what is your original face? If you're not just your thoughts and your emotions and sensations and words and labels, then get to the place before those arise, before even your mother and father were born. And then she says, you'll see through the method that underlies them all. It's one of the things that I've so delighted in when I first encountered it without really understanding it very well, that all of Buddhism, every teaching, every practice, every monastery, every robe, every piece of incense, every action, every vow, in one sense can be spoken of as a method, upaya, a raft to cross to the other shore. But that can also, in that way, we can misunderstand and think because it's a method, because it's just an upaya, because it doesn't have any inherent lasting value like gold, we think, then it hasn't. What good is it? Why bother? We should just throw it away. And that's not understanding it. It is gold. And it is gold because it has no inherent value. It's gold because it can help us come to life. And when we see through the method that underlies it all, then we can really appreciate all that we use. It's like liberating everything. So that it doesn't bind us and we don't bind it, right? Which is kind of what happens in religions, right? The methods get bound, right? They become precious. They become, you know, defendable. Worthy of being fought and killing for. Not in Buddhism. Seeing through the method means that we've seen through ourselves. Then the mountain blossoms and flowing streams will rejoice with you. Sounds very much like when sages and wise ones live in the mountains, because the mountains belong to them. Rocks and trees flourish and abound, and the birds and beasts take on a supernatural excellence. It's the same mind. Jingan, Dogen, Buddha, you. seen this original purity. It's the same purity. It's the same liberation. At the end of her life, Xingang wrote this poem. After teaching and preaching, well, in her latter part of life, she wasn't dying. After teaching and preaching, running about for so many years, now I've shut my door and retired to the hidden forest spring. Having kicked open heaven and earth, I can now rest my feet. Alone I sit before the winter window, the shimmering moon full. Spending the day in a foolish way, no need for any method. Here within, there's neither existence nor non-existence. Straight and tall, I sit, cutting off the path of sage and fools. Since time immemorial to the present day, it has been so. This is that 10th Oxfordian picture. Dusty, barefoot, spending the day in a foolish way, leaning on her staff, no need for any method. She sits, going beyond the path of sage and fool, of nun and abbess, of accomplishing, of going beyond. Very simple, very ordinary. And since time immemorial to now, it has been so. That we must travel so far, that we must practice so diligently, that we must take refuge in so much wisdom and teachings and practices to arrive at this place that we have never been absent from. And yet, or rather and, as Dada Roshi used to often say, all the way to heaven is heaven itself. All the way is the way. Since the beginning, you're like this, I am like this.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.